Hi, I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
And I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week, we're talking about things on toast, re-embracing the canned bean, and with Emily Pastor, author of the soon-to-be-released book, The Joys of Jewish Preserving. But first, let's talk about something that we read this week. This is like a reoccurring theme for us.
Yeah.
And back to the topic of Whole Foods.
It's true. And so by the time this episode airs, this is going to be sort of a couple weeks old news, but crazy. Amazon bought Whole Foods.
Amazon.com purchases Whole Foods. Now Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, the internet supermarket. I mean, you know, Whole Foods, where is this all going? It feels like something out of a dystopian novel.
A little bit. I've been sort of watching a terrible Canadian sci-fi show lately called Dark Matter, and in it the corporations run everything, and I'm like, shoot, that's where we're headed.
Well, on the one hand, it's like, you know, my dissatisfaction with Whole Foods has just been mounting and mounting and mounting, so can they make it any worse for me? Probably not. But will they make it better?
I don't know.
It's hard to imagine.
I mean, the thinking behind it from a business perspective, I get that, like, Amazon, one of the holes in their market share is sort of the in-person buying experience. And so this definitely gives them that. And also they haven't had a lot of like grocery. They've been dabbling with, Amazon Fresh and those things.
Well, one thing I was thinking about is how does this relate to Amazon Go, which is a store that they have, I think it's like a prototype.
Yeah.
Where there's no cashiers. Have we talked about this?
I don't think we have, but I mean, I've read about it.
Basically, you go in, everything has, like, there's an app that you have to have on your phone, and then I guess everything is somehow, like, coded or microchipped or whatever, GPS. I don't know how they do it. The inventory, and you just get your stuff, and then you walk out. No checkout. It knows what you took, and it bills you through the app. I have no position on that. Like, I don't.
Yeah. No, it'll be interesting to see if like that becomes a technology they use at Whole Foods. One of the things that I heard someone, I think, post on Facebook that I thought was really interesting is that over the last couple of weeks before the announcement was made, they were at their local Whole Foods and they saw them discontinuing certain items. And the person, the clerk who was doing it, the worker, said something about how they were discontinuing things that you could get on Amazon Prime. And so I do wonder, like, where the are they going to not carry things and direct people to Amazon Prime for certain things versus have them be available at the stores? It's going to be interesting to see how it all shakes out.
That frightens me in a way because I can't everyone loves Amazon Prime, but it doesn't work for me because I live in South Philly. I have a stoop. You can't leave a box on my stoop. Someone will steal it, you know?
Yeah.
And my street is really busy now. So even when I get something through FedEx on my old street, they used to knock on the door and like wait for me to come get it.
Yeah.
And now they just knock, drop, and run. So if I'm not home when the thing is delivered, it's gone.
Yeah.
So anyway, we'll see. I'm breaking up with Whole Foods. It's like a slow, painful, messy breakup, but it's happening.
I still think you should go to the big Whole Foods and just get out.
I really hate it there, as you know.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens to Whole Foods and how the merger of those two sort of massive companies that are such big parts of all of our lives, like how that shakes out.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Time will tell. Let's talk about something more comforting, shall we?
Yes. So this recently for dinner, at least in my household, so it's hot. I've gotten a CSA share. So I have this confluence of like a lot of produce and not a big desire to cook. And so I've been reverting back to a standard, which is things on toast. And also I expand this to also include things in a tortilla. You know, so these have been my, like, default dinners lately.
Well, you know I've been eating a lot of vegan tacos lately.
I do, yes.
I'm into it. Things on toast. And actually, we talked about my cholesterol last time. And because I'm not eating breakfast, a lot of times I'm eating things on toast for breakfast. Or because I'm not eating eggs every day for breakfast, I'm eating a lot of things on toast. Avocado, naturally. This morning I had peanut butter, almond butter, tahini sauce. Also, I've been making a vegan ricotta.
That's fun. How does that work? Is it with tofu?
I've made it with soaked cashews, lemon juice, nutrition yeast, a tiny bit of agave syrup in the food processor. So you get like a curdy ricotta texture. The texture is amazingly spot on. I think it needs a little soy. It needs something like, there's like a blandness, like a mildness, like a milkiness that you don't get from cashews. So I think next time I do it, I'm going to use maybe 2/3 cashew, 1/3 silken tofu.
Yeah.
And I'll report back.
A couple of things.
That's a great thing on toast.
That sounds really good. The things I've been putting on toast lately, I made a big pot of beans recently, and you know, it's a British classic that I think we should embrace in the U.S. So I've been sort of mashing pinto beans onto toast with a little bit of hot sauce.
Do you put any butter or oil on the toast to prevent it sogging out?
No, I just eat it really fast. The other thing I've done that I discovered a couple years ago that I really am enjoying right now is prepping sort of a greens spread. So it's a recipe concept I got from Marcella Says, the Marcella Hazan book. And essentially you blanch, like rapini works really well for it. And then you strip off the, you know, you leave the stems behind and you strip off the, like, the leaves and the flowers and you chop it up real fine. And then you saute it up in a little bit of olive oil with garlic. And she has you add cheese, but I don't typically add it to the mix. So then what it ends up is that and a little lemon juice. So you have this sort of garlicky, savory, chopped green thing that you can then put on toast and top with a little pecorino or something. And it's really good.
It sounds great.
It's one of my favorites. And yeah. So that's a really good thing to put on a piece of toast. And then also we're heading into tomato season. So you could put a big hunk of tomato on top of that greens on toast and have something that really feels satisfying.
I've definitely been slicing little grape tomatoes and putting them on top of my vegan ricotta with like a little drizzle of olive oil and hot pepper flakes.
That sounds really
pretty
good.
Yummy. Yeah, I haven't started cooking with it yet. I've just been putting it on toast, but I want to try like some baked pastas or other stuff. You know, I've really been cutting back on cheese. So I have to have treats. Something that feels rich and flavorful like that, and it's good on toast. So I haven't been doing a bean on toast, but I have been doing lots of beans in tortillas.
Yeah, and I do feel like a toasted tortilla is almost the same thing as toast. And so, like, this whole week, that pot of beans has been our kind of dinner time salvation because
we taught a class this week. We had an event.
Yeah.
I have been really dedicated to Monday night spinning. So it's been not been the best week in mine or your house for home cooking.
Yeah, except that I feel pretty successful in that neither
you planned
Scott,
ahead.
Yeah, I planned ahead. Neither Scott nor I have gotten takeout all week. We've both either had toast or like beans on toast or made little burritos or like
Dan definitely got takeout last night.
Did he? Yes. Well, Scott is still doing Weight Watchers too, so he's protective of his points. So if he can come home and have dinner that's a very low point thing and then he can, you know, like have some sort of little treat later, he's a happier human.
I finally finished up that red pepper salad that we ate for lunch last week, and I've talked about on this show before. It's a recipe from the Zahav cookbook. It's a cooked red pepper salad with white beans, and I love that on toast.
I was gonna say that would have been, we ate that with hummus and pita.
I've had
but,
it
but yeah
just with out of a spoon with a spoon out of the container on toast with pita and hummus. It's pretty versatile.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Oh, and you know what else I've been making in the absence of cheese? It's like because you know I'm a baby. Like if Dan is having cheese and crackers, I have to have something with crackers. Tapenade.
Yeah.
Which is a good, you know, a paste of olives and capers and chilies. It's and garlic. It's very, very much fills that cheese void with a cracker or a toast, and is quite filling and nourishing as well, I might add.
Sounds good. All right.
So we talked a little bit about beans on toast and beans on tortillas. And as I mentioned to you, after being a long time hater of canned beans and an advocate of cooking beans from scratch, I'm kind of back on the canned bean because I'm just eating so many beans.
I remember you saying to me last week that you're eating so many beans that sometimes they're taking the place of vegetables in your diet, right?
Yeah, well, beans are one of those superfoods that helps lower your cholesterol because they have the type of fiber that helps absorb cholesterol out of your bloodstream.
Yeah.
Or I guess it's probably out of your digestive system before you gets to your bloodstream. But nonetheless, like oatmeal, it is a big superstar for lowering cholesterol. So I've been eating so many beans. Beans in the morning, beans like with eggs, beans. I've been doing so many vegan tacos, which I just love so much. Like a little sauteed onion with some kale or charred red peppers, and then black beans, pinto beans. They're just, you know, so easy. Like for lunch, I know we talk a lot about making lunch at home, and people who go to the office every day probably will roll their eyes when I say this. And even though I do have the luxury of going to my kitchen to make lunch, sometimes I just don't have that much time.
Yeah.
So you can really make a bean taco fast. I mean, like I'm talking about under 10 minutes if you have a can of beans that you're just going to like.
Yeah. And for the people who work in offices, you could prep tacos ahead of time, you know, like in the morning or the night before.
Yeah. And put it
saute it up, you know, put it in a container, reheat it when you get to work and fold it up in a taco.
But I've also discovered that I like canned navy beans more than canned cannellini beans, which I thought the reverse was true. Canned navy beans are really little. And the cannellini beans are bigger, and I think they break a lot more. So I've been buying the white navy beans, which is what we had in the red pepper salad, because I did not cook beans from scratch for that day. I just and again, nothing against cooking beans from scratch at all. I still prefer the flavor, and it is a totally worthy cooking project. But because I've been trying to eat more beans, it's just easier. I just decided to like cut myself some slack and buy the canned beans.
I think that's okay. And are you finding that you like them more than you thought? Like, are you disappointed in the flavor? Are you okay with it?
I'm good with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, am I disappointed in the flavor? I guess part of me is like, I think canned beans are maybe better than they used to be, or maybe I'm buying a better brand of them, or maybe I'm just a better cook so that I can make them taste better after I've like rinsed them well and thrown them into my recipe. But they are not objectionable at all. And in some cases, in that red pepper salad, because they absorb so many of the other flavors, I really couldn't have told the difference, I don't think.
No, I definitely feel like canned beans have improved over the years. Is there a particular brand you're buying, or?
Resentfully, I am buying the Whole Foods 365 brand. Do you have a brand that you like? I bet you get Trader Joe's.
I mostly get Trader Joe's because Trader Joe's is two blocks away. Yeah. I buy the organic Trader Joe's beans. And sometimes if I'm at Whole Foods, I'll get those as well. But I guess I do think that if you buy really cheap, like grocery store brand beans, sometimes they're a little sludgier or they're broken or they can be really salty.
Well, really salty is usually okay with me. like I said, the cannellini beans I felt were like that.
Yeah.
But the navy beans, black beans, pinto beans, and chickpeas, and black-eyed peas have all done right by me in recent weeks.
Now let me ask you this. Are you still – would you ever make hummus with a canned bean? You're looking at me like that is a
– The hummus that you ate at my house was made with canned
was
beans.
Was it?
Yeah.
Because I remember you used to say you would never – you only make it with beans you cooked from scratch. The hummus I ate at your house was delicious.
Usually I do only make it with – I guess for me the question was, can I make a really good hummus with canned beans? Like what can I do to canned beans? And I did adapt it from the recipe in the Zahav book, but I used canned beans. And I rinsed them very well, and I warmed them and – like I got them warm, because I think it helped them become smoother. It was like an extra step, but I think it did make it almost indistinguishable.
I honestly, when I looked at that hummus, I thought it was just your standard Zahav hummus, and I thought it was terrific. So
yeah,
I think you may have
I noodled around a little bit. I'll send you my notes if you want to do it. Do you guys make hummus a lot here?
I go through phases where sometimes I'll make hummus and then I don't do it for a month, and then I'll make like a batch of, you know, three batches in a row.
For what it's worth, I do think that the cooked beans are better. But if, as I say to my husband all the time, and I sometimes need to say to myself, particularly as it pertains to the kitchen, is don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. You know, if I can't eat, especially I guess I was leaning hard on cheese for like a quick lunch for myself or a quick snack. And I have to make it quick and easy or else I'm going to either – you know, eat something I don't want to be eating because I'm trying to get these cholesterol numbers down, or skip lunch and become like a hungry, angry monster, which is not
useful.
No, that's not good either. So anyway, If you guys have canned bean brands besides Whole Foods or Trader Joe's that you think are good, let me know. Because as I mentioned, I'm having the long, slow, painful breakup from Whole Foods.
Our guest today is Emily Pastor. Emily is a food blogger and cookbook author based in Chicago, and her new book, The Joys of Jewish Preserving, will be hitting bookstores in the next couple of weeks. This is Emily's second time on the show, so welcome back, Emily.
Thanks for having me again, you guys.
We're so happy you're here. I'm glad that you were hopping through Philadelphia. You were on the show last year when your first book, Food Swap, came out.
Yep.
And now you're back with a new book. Two books in 2 years. That's really amazing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
2016 was... I'm not doing that year again.
So tell us a little bit about the new book.
So the book is an exploration of home food preservation in the Jewish culinary tradition, both Ashkenazi, which is the Eastern European Russian side of Judaism that most of us in America are more familiar with, but also Sephardic, the Sephardic tradition, which is the, you know, Mediterranean, Middle Eastern, North African side of Judaism as well. So both kinds of preserves, both flavor profiles, both kinds of ingredients are in there. A lot of jam, a lot of pickles and marinated vegetables, and then a little section, sort of a use your preserve section about with some baked goods and some main dishes that incorporate preserves or things like challah that, you know, you need to spread your preserves on.
Yeah. No, that's perfect. So tell us a little bit about the process of writing this book, because as someone who also has written preserving books, there's not anything quite like this on the market. And so, you know, I'm curious what your research process was and how you came to, how this book came to be.
Yeah. You know, so for me, it's really the marriage of my two loves, which is preserving and Jewish food.
Yeah.
And the inspiration came just from the realization that so many of the iconic, Jewish foods are either preserves themselves, such as the kosher dill pickle or sauerkraut, or incorporate preserves. And I'm thinking of things like rugelach, you know, that Jewish cookie that has jam in it, or hamantash in that triangular Jewish cookie that we eat at Purim that has jam in it, or applesauce on latkes, things like that. So I was really struck by these are some of the most iconic Jewish foods, and they incorporate, they have some sort of preserved element. And so with the, from that starting point, I kind of went a lot deeper, and did start doing a ton of research to, try to see what the tradition had been, you know, in sort of, pre-America, you know, in the old countries, what the preserving tradition had been, for our ancestors.
You know, I'm always curious as people write cookbooks, like, was there anything that you loved that didn't make the cut? Or do you feel like this was a really good, that everything you were passionate about made it into the book?
Yeah, I can't remember something that got cut that I was unhappy about. I mean, there was definitely things that were working better and worse.
Yeah. Well, that always happens.
And I was trying to be mindful, you know, so I did do a lot of research, and there was a lot of historical context in the recipe headnotes and whatnot. But I definitely want to tell people that these recipes are contemporary or modern. They're all my creations. They're how we cook today, you know, based on what I'm finding in my farmers markets and what I can find year round in the supermarket. So there's a lot of historical context, but everything's been adapted and modernized for how we want to cook and preserve today.
There's a recipe in there that I noticed that does that you have a mulberry jam recipe, but often mulberries are hard to come by. So how did you overcome that obstacle of something that's traditional, but you can't find the fruit to make it?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So mulberries are particularly important in the Sephardic world. And I think in America, we think of them as like a nuisance for the most part because they like fall in our cars and they make the sidewalks messy. But in Sephardic cuisine, they're treasured and they're beloved and they're really important. So I felt like I would be remiss if I didn't include a mulberry jam recipe. And I do give some hints about how you might think about foraging for mulberries. P.S. put a tarp down and shake the branches. But I wanted to also make something that was a bit more accessible. So I have what I call a faux mulberry jam, which is a combination of blueberries and blackberries to sort of mimic that sweet tart taste and the texture, but with ingredients that are a lot easier to find. Blueberries are not particularly Jewish. So,
well, yeah, I can see that. I feel like blueberries, aren't they indigenous to North America?
Exactly.
And so the cultivated blueberry came out of the wild blueberries from sort of Maine and the Northeast. So you wouldn't find that. It makes sense.
Yeah.
Mulberries are one of those things that I always miss the season on, because they do. They grow here in Philadelphia. Like, there are a lot of mulberry trees. If you know where to look, you can find them. But I think they're already gone. Like, if you don't catch it, they have a very short season. But it's cool to, next time I'll bring a tarp with me and I'll do a little
give it a shake.
Shaking. So you want to tell us a little bit about like the styles of preservation in here? Because, I know you've got some boiling water bath canning, but for those people who are a little intimidated by canning, which, you know, I'm always trying to teach people to can, but there's still lots out there that, don't feel comfortable with that. Do they need to have those skills in order to, use the recipes in the book?
Definitely not. You know, my hope with the book is that canners who aren't Jewish are going to be intrigued, by some new flavor combinations and some new, preserving ideas that they hadn't thought about. And they're going to want to buy the book, but also that folks who love to cook Jewish cuisine and are interested in Jewish cuisine, but haven't canned before. I'm also hoping they'll, be interested in the book as well. And certainly I'm with you. I would love everyone to acquire the skill. if you're not already water bath canning, I walk through the procedures as you do in your books. So if you don't know how to do it, you can teach yourself through this book. That being said, there are plenty of recipes in the book that are for quick pickles or refrigerator pickles, certainly, by design. And any of the recipes in the book, you know, you can make them as a refrigerator jam. You can make them as a refrigerator pickle. The quantities aren't very big for the most part. You know, you're going to get maybe 3 or 4 jars, as a yield. So that's not something that's necessary. And you can always have the recipe, but that's not something that's going to overwhelm you. If you want to do the whole recipe up to the point where I have you processing the jars in a boiling water bath, to make them shelf stable and you just want to keep them in your fridge, please. That's great too.
A couple
fermented recipes too. I want to throw that in there. So,
And for the fermented recipes, people make them, they sit on their counter for a little while and then they move them to the refrigerator.
Exactly.
So I'm just flipping through the book now. Are there any favorites in here that you feel like if someone's going to pick it up and try just one or two things that they should not miss?
There's a plum butter recipe, which is so delicious. I think one of the tests is, you know, I developed these recipes like, say, last year, and whatever I'm making again this year when I don't have to make it to develop it and test it, that's proof that it's a really good recipe. That plum butter, wow, is super, super delicious. I put it in rugelach. I put it on bread. I put it in yogurt. That's a favorite. The one I've been doing on the pickle savory side, I've been doing the pickled okra recipe a bunch, because I love how it surprises people who don't like okra. You've talked about this as well.
Definitely.
And it's very easy. I mean, a lot of, you know, if you're pickling carrots, you've got to peel them. You've got to cut them. The okra doesn't need you to do anything to it before you pop it in a jar practically. Yeah.
Now, I don't think of okra as being a traditionally Jewish ingredient. Is there... In one, is it?
Yes, it's Sephardic.
Yeah.
So, I'm so glad you brought that up. So of course, those of us in America think of okra as something from the American South. It's, you know, associated with African American cuisine as well. And the reason is that okra comes from West Africa, okra the plant.
Ah.
So it was brought to America with the slave trade, you know, and became a really important crop in the American South. But by the same token, it went from West Africa to North Africa to the Mediterranean. And it is a very typical ingredient in Sephardic cooking. I know it doesn't strike us as Jewish, but it is. And much like people in the American South, the Sephardic Jews, once tomatoes, which of course are a New World crop, once they hit Europe and started to become incorporated in their cuisines, they were combining okra and tomatoes just as people do in the South here.
That's so cool. I love that. So you're going to be touring a little bit with this book. Where are you going to be in the coming weeks?
I'm going to be out on the West Coast, which I'm really, really excited about. I'm going to be in Portland. I'm going to be in Seattle at Book Larder, mm-hmm. which is an awesome cookbook bookstore in Seattle on July 10th. And then I'm going to be in the Bay Area. I'm going to be at Omnivore Books, which is San Francisco's awesome cookbook bookstore, on July 12th. I'm doing a dinner in Berkeley at Saul's Deli, inspired by the book. I'm really excited about that. And I'll be at the Ferry Plaza Farmers Market on July 15th.
That is so exciting. And so if people want to check your tour schedule too, is it on your website?
It is, yeah.
And it's westoftheloop.com?
Westoftheloop.com, and there's a tab for events and classes, and all the dates and links are listed there.
Great. Emily, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It is always so fun to be with you girls.
Nice. No segment alert. We've decided to give At the Market a rest for a little bit, and while we introduce a new segment that we're going to call What We're Loving.
Yeah.
And we decided that we'd kick off this new segment with a bubbly, sparkling water, a very special one, made not with artificial flavorings, but with real fruit juice, known to Marisa for a long time. But only recently discovered by me, or I shouldn't say discovered. I recently got my hands on some. And do you want to tell our listeners what it is?
It's the Spindrift seltzer or soda.
Spindrift. It's I don't, you could call it a seltzer or yeah. a soda. It's really 90% seltzer water, 10% real fruit juice. What are your favorite flavors?
I really like the raspberry lime, I think it is.
Raspberry lime.
I mean, I like all, so I buy it at Costco in the big container. And
that's
what
I got. Yeah. And there's only three flavors in there.
I think, isn't it four?
Maybe you're right. It's the raspberry lime, cucumber, lemon, and grapefruit.
And I really like all of them. The cucumber is the one that often gets left to the last.
I really like the cucumber.
Do you?
My sister said the same thing, that she didn't like the cucumber. So I decided I was going to go for that first and then to see, figured it would only be, Spindrift would only be up from there. But I really liked it.
I don't dislike it. It's just kind of like the one I reach for last. But it's good. It is good.
My sister also prefers the raspberry lime yeah. above all.
I was out recently in Western Massachusetts, and I discovered blackberry Spindrift, which they don't
what?
Include in the Costco assortment pack. But it was really good.
I don't think I was even aware there were more flavors.
Well, and what I really it sounds silly to get excited about seltzer or
no.
sparkling water.
No.
But in this culture of ours where everybody's all excited about LaCroix, you know, and which I also drink and like, I'm really – the thing that's so nice about Spindrift is that it's real fruit.
Yeah. I have definitely a room in my heart for both of them. Like, I'm lately been hitting the coconut LaCroix pretty hard.
Yeah.
It does not taste natural at all.
No, it tastes like you're drinking a bottle of suntan lotion.
But I kind of like it. There's something, I don't know. It doesn't taste natural at all.
No.
It's like not typical, but I don't know. I guess sometimes I feel like it really hits the spot at like 5 o'clock when I might have otherwise in my old drinking days be pouring a glass of like sparkling rosé or something. It's nothing like that. But
no, I totally get it though.
It's fun in that way to me.
Yeah.
I can't. And I love this, the fake suntan lotion smell somehow. It's a divisive flavor, but it's totally different from the Spindrift experience.
Yeah. No, the Spindrift, it has a little bit of color from the real fruit
yeah.
juice.
Yeah. The raspberry is nice. Lime yeah. is so pretty in a wine glass.
Yeah.
I'm in favor of it. My sister, actually, who quit drinking as well, has been toting, you know, she lives in a really small town. So
yeah.
as much as I gripe about the non-alcoholic beverage options that I have, like, it's worse for her. but she's been carting Spindrift around in her bag.
Oh, my
because
gosh.
Because when she works at a school, so when she goes to university events where there's, like, just wine and beer, she wants to have something.
That's
I'm
smart.
Like, go, Jill.
That's awesome. Good for her.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's good. And I also, I use it sometimes in combination with like a shrub or some sort of syrup I've made if I want to like boost that flavor, like the fruit flavor a little bit more. I also like it, in combination like the lemon lime or I think
it's just lemon.
Lemon, in combination with kombucha.
That sounds great.
Because I often like to, often kombucha can be too much. And so if I cut it with a little sparkling water, I like it better.
I've been, combining the cucumber with a dash of bitters and like a little squeeze of lime, and it's very cocktailish.
That's fun.
Yeah. It's very summery and refreshing.
Well, if you haven't tried Spindrift, we highly recommend them because makes you feel like you're having something special. Well, I think that's it for this week's installment of Local Mouthful. Our thanks go out to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo. to Raina Rose for providing our music, and to the folks who have edited the show this week, because we're working with multiple editors now. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. And you can sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out all the show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.